looking at getting to know Jesus through the Old Testament. And the first couple of times here in looking at some of these, we've been focusing on, some of the statements and the way that Matthew in verses 1 through 17 of his gospel, which is basically the genealogies, how he takes us back to the Old Testament through those genealogies and how important and significant those are to our better understanding of who Jesus really is. Last week we started looking at this this part of it, kind of basically what we call the story so far. In other words, here's what's taking place. We looked at the story from Abraham to David. And in that, we were talking about the nature of the problem, that when God called Abraham out of the Ur of the Chaldees, it was a situation where the world had basically separated itself from God, was steeped in sin, and God is beginning to work His plan through Abraham by calling him to begin and making this promise to Abraham, that promise being what? Through you, all nations of the earth will be blessed. And that's the key to that, is all nations. And so, we're looking at the problem of sin and separation from God. And then the idea of the election was that God elected Abraham, the 75-year-old man, out of all the people of the world, and through him created a nation of people to be able to work that plan. And one of the significant things that we said last week about this particular part of it was that God chose to attach His identity to Abraham, okay, in such a way that the people of Israel would refer to God by what means? Yeah, he's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That was the identity that people would recognize and say, yes, this is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And to the Israelite people, he became known as Father Abraham. Okay, so he was the father of that promise. Then we talk about the redemption, the part of the role that the Exodus plays in this whole plan that God has of redeeming man. The Exodus is the primary model of what redemption means in the Bible, that God is delivering mankind from the bondage that they are in. In the case of the Exodus was, the physical bondage in slavery to the Egyptians. But in that, it shows God's sovereignty again, that God is concerned about all nations, not just one nation. The Exodus wasn't just simply a story, or isn't just simply a story about the Israelite people, but it is a story, even the wider, broader sense, it's a story about God's sovereignty over the world, you see. And so, when God is wanting to work His desires, there's nothing in the world and no power in the world that can stop God, because He is God of the universe. And so that's part of what that story is really all about. And I think that sometimes we miss that particular part of the story in focusing on the Passover and so forth. But we need to understand that story in the context of the total plan of God in fulfilling that promise to Abraham that through you all nations of the earth would be blessed. And that includes God, exerting His power over the nations of the world. We came then to the covenant. We were talking about after God led the Israelite people, who are now a nation of people. It's no longer just, a family and a handful of people, but it's a nation of people, the Israelite nation. And God leads them out of this bondage in Egypt, and brings them to Mount Sinai. And the key event that we talked about that occurred at Mount Sinai was what? Anybody recall? Do what? Well, yeah, it was the covenant that God established with the Israelite people. And that covenant basically has within it the terms are what? What are the terms of this covenant? Okay. Okay. I'll be your God. You will be my people. I will bless you and take care of you. And you need to be obedient to me. Okay? But one of the significant things that we mentioned about this aspect and this covenant aspect of it is the what is God calling upon them in basing this covenant is on what God had already done for the Israelite people, not based on simple promises of what he would do, but rather on what he has already done. He already led the Israelites out of bondage in Egypt. You see? He had already freed them and brought them to Mount Sinai. And that's the base there of the covenant and what God had already done for them. You see? Not just simply promises of what he would do, which we mentioned that particular point makes Abraham's obedience even more significant because Abraham obeyed when? Before God had done anything. You see? God called him and Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. And nothing had been done yet except a promise that was given. And then we talked about the inheritance that this all leads to is this promised land. The land of inheritance that God had told the Israelite people that they would receive. He would take them to this land of promise and give them that land. And we saw in that the first generation of Israelites that had come out of Egypt in this bondage situation, what happened to them? Yeah, they perished in the wilderness because of disobedience and unbelief, you see. And eventually what we saw was this succeeding generations of Israelites that found themselves in disobedience to God to the point where they rejected God as their leader and king, you see, and they demanded what? They demanded a king to be over them like all the other nations, and that's the significant part here. They wanted to be like all the other nations around them, whereas what was God's intention for them?
To be set apart,
to be different than all the other nations. They wanted to blend in. God wanted them to be different, you see? And so they rejected God in that way. And then the last part of all of that was that God, in that request on their behalf and giving them what they asked for, established the monarchy. And we recognize the monarchy mainly under who?
Under David.
Okay? Abraham is looked upon and considered by the Israelite people to be, as we said earlier, he's the father of the Israelites. David is the king. He's King David, you see. So from this point, we look at the section from David. Okay, the monarchy has been established. We look at from David to the exile. Okay, so let's take a look at some things that are going on here in this particular part. Okay, the first part that we have in this is what we're going to refer to as division. Okay? We have division. Under David and the monarchy that David had, we had a unified kingdom, didn't we? Okay? You know, for the most part, the story is, you know, David was able to unify the Israelite people under one king, one nation of Israel, the kingdom expanded, and so forth. And then David passed on, and he gave the monarchy to who? Solomon, his son. Okay? Solomon consolidated the kingdom that David built. Okay? He built a temple, and that temple represented what? God's presence amongst the people, right? Okay? But Solomon also introduced Israel to foreign trade, to foreign culture, and to foreign wealth and foreign influence, didn't he? Okay, Ray? Okay.
And Solomon really lived in a time of peace.
Okay.
More than his father did. That's why he was the one elected to build his temple for the Lord.
Okay.
That was the major difference.
Right. Okay.
That one of the major differences is he didn't want to be a part of building his temple because of
right. It's interesting that we tend to look at the situation, and you're right, yeah, that way. That's the reason why God did not allow David to build the temple, but rather Solomon. But we typically look at the reign of Solomon as being a reign or a time of peace, but was it really?
No.
Okay? It really wasn't, simply for the fact that there was really not a lot of peace amongst the Israelite people themselves. Okay, because you see, it's really under Solomon that the warnings that Samuel gave, and I'm going to have Ray, you're the one that's going to read this for us, right, in 1 Samuel 8, 10 through 18. It's really under Solomon that these warnings came to pass, you know, more than anything, that during the reign of Solomon is where we find a tremendous amount of hardship brought upon the people of Israel, and a lot of discontent. So there wasn't a tremendous amount of peace in that regard. There was from their neighbors, okay, but from within the kingdom itself, there was a lot of hardship and turmoil. Ray, would you read that passage for us, 1 Samuel 8, 10 through 18.
So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. And he said, this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your son and place them for himself and his chariot and among his horsemen, and they will run before the chariot. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of 50, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariot. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. And he will take the best of your field and your vineyard and your olive grove and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyard and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants, and your best young men and your donkeys, and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flock, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that
Okay? Typically, when we think of Solomon and his reign as king, what are the things that usually come to mind?
Well, we do think about it being a time of peace.
Okay.
With his enemies. That's the biggest thing. We tend to focus sometimes on Solomon's wisdom.
Okay, the wisdom.
Story, you know, of the child that the order divided, you know, to determine who the real mother was. It's funny because I was going to ask you, I don't think we think too much about the heavy taxes. You know, we don't talk right. about that, at least in the church,
right.
much. But evidently, it was really onerous.
Well, again, you know, we think of the wisdom.
Yeah.
We also think of what was it when Solomon first became king, okay, and the Lord appeared to him, and what did the Lord tell him? Anybody recall? He said, do what, Cindy? Yeah, ask for whatever you want, and I'll give it to you. And Solomon asked for what?
Wisdom.
Wisdom to lead the country, to lead the people, right? And God then told Solomon, because you asked for wisdom and not
riches,
I'm going to give you both, right? Now, did God keep that promise?
Yes.
And you can read in the descriptions in the scriptures here about the wealth that Solomon amassed in his kingdom, right? Where did a lot of that wealth come from? That's the question that we oftentimes don't consider, you see. Yes, a lot of it came from tributes that were paid from other countries and so forth, but a lot of it came from where?
Taxation.
From the backs of the people.
Yeah.
The Israelite people. Yeah. And the taxes that were exerted upon them and so forth to supply the needs of the king. You see. And so again, we look at, you know, the period of Solomon as king, and we tend to focus on all those good things, and we tend to miss, I think, sometimes, you know, what the backdrop of all of that is. Okay? Exactly. That's what. Yeah, that's what we just read here a moment ago. When, you know, when they beg for a king, we want to have a king like all the other nations. And what Ray just read for us, Samuel gave him a warning and said, okay, you can have your king, but here's what the king's going to do. Okay? Now, in the period of the United Kingdom, how many kings did we have? Three. There were only three. Okay? Started out with Saul, then David, and then Solomon. Okay? So within this time span of these three kings, okay, what God had told them was going to happen, it happened. Okay, such to the point that we come to, in this period of division here, we come to Rehoboam, who was Solomon's son. Okay? And so that we understand the nature of what was going on, when Rehoboam became the king, the people made a request of him. What was that request? Yeah, lighten our burden, lighten our load. You know, your thumb is too heavy on us here. You see, your father's thumb has been too heavy, they said. But Rehoboam, instead of listening to the older advisors, took the advice of the younger advisors and said what?
Bear down on them.
Yeah, you think my father's thumb was heavy, you wait till you feel my thumb. Okay? And because of Rehoboam's, you know, decision to go that way, we then have the division that took place within the kingdom. The kingdom is split. There's a revolt. Jeroboam led the revolt of the people in the northern part of the kingdom. So from this point on, we now have two separate kingdoms of God's people. We have the northern kingdom, which took the name of Israel, and we have the southern kingdom, which took the name of Judah. Okay? And what we find happening here, we go from this part to, let's take a look at what's taking place in the 9th century B.C. Okay? During this particular time, there is a tremendous amount of instability in the kingdom, okay? Both kingdoms. You see, what we have is there is a succession of kings, some within the lineage, some without the lineage, and we have some who are good kings, that is, those who are trying to get the people focused back on obeying God's word, and we have others who are disregarding God's word altogether and doing whatever it is that they want. Most of those kings were of the latter type. Okay? Ahab and Jezebel come on the scene. Okay? Ahab is described as one of the worst kings. In fact, the other kings that come after Ahab are compared to Ahab oftentimes, aren't they? You see? And how wicked Ahab was. But Jezebel played a major role. Okay? Jezebel was a native of Phoenicia from the city of Tyre. Okay? Jezebel was not an Israelite. And what Jezebel attempted to do was to convert the Israelite people to worship of her own religion in the cult of Baal. Okay? So we have all of that part going on. And during this particular point, we have the age of the prophets. Okay? And for the most part, what are the prophets attempting to do? Yeah. They're trying to warn the people, but even more importantly, what they're trying to do is to warn the leaders. You know, they're trying to get the people, you know, to do, but they're warning the leaders. If you don't stop doing this, if you don't stop going this direction, God's going to take things into his hands and you're going to be punished and so forth. And that's basically my paraphrase of all the warnings that the prophets gave and so forth. Continually warning the leaders and the people to turn back to God or else. Okay? In the 8th century B.C., we have a greater separation between what we'll call the haves and the have-nots in Israelite society, amongst the Israelite people. Okay, you have a greater division between the poor classes and the wealthy classes. Okay, there's a greater separation there. There is a tremendous amount more of oppression of the people by the royal classes. Okay? So during this particular time, you know, things are getting A, better, B, worse, or C, about the same. B, worse. They're continually getting worse. The condition in both kingdoms here, okay? As far as obedience to God's law, by this particular time, you know, it was abysmal. It was almost non-existent. Again, with the exception of the times when certain kings would come to reign and would attempt to establish the law again with God and the covenant and to get the people back, but that lasted only for a brief time. And then they would go back to where they were before, right?
One of the things that Jeroboam did, he disobeyed God and set up two separate
right.
That one in Dan and one in Bethel.
Right.
So people would go and
worship there, right?
It was totally against God.
Absolutely. Exactly. Right.
Right.
Absolutely. And what we find in this is the ones who are responsible for this are the leaders of the people. We find the religious leaders are basically just ineffective completely. And in many, many instances, the religious leaders of the people are you know, joining right in with the kings and, you know, and the secular leaders and so forth. Such that by the time of 722 B.C., we have the northern kingdom of Israel is conquered by Assyria, and the people are carried into exile. Okay, so at this particular point, the northern kingdom ceases to exist. Okay, in the 7th century B.C., we find Judah still remaining as a kingdom, and they will remain as a kingdom for 136 years after the fall of Israel. But then finally, in 586 B.C., they fall to the Babylonians. And they, too, are carried off into exile. Okay? So, what do we learn from this particular part in history, and what does it show us and demonstrate to us in this connection that we're looking for in these events from the Old Testament to Jesus? Okay. Well, first of all, from this particular part of history, we find an affirmation that Yahweh, or the God of Israel, was sovereign over the world and not just Israel. Okay? And we see that, you know, happening and being reconfirmed as God is working His plans. The prophets confirmed over and over again God's use of other nations, you say, to punish the Israelite people. Okay? So again, this affirmation of God's control and sovereignty over everyone. We see also from this God's demand of moral character of His people during this period. The prophets continually called the people back to God and His laws. And this is demonstrated over and over again, not only for nations, but also for individuals. In other words, there are all kinds of different cases and stories that we read through this period of history of individuals that God, you know, called on and God held accountable for certain things, and as well as the nations as a whole. Okay? And so that part of it is tremendously important. God demands moral character of His people. The third thing that we learn from this particular period is that God cared more about adherence to His laws than external religious rituals. Okay? And that's significant, and we'll see in a few moments here, you know, how does that particular part play into the role in the ministry of Jesus. Since the days of Samuel, they knew that obedience is better than sacrifice. Okay? Did I get somebody to read 1 Samuel 15:22? Okay, Ted, would you read that for us?
So Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams."
Excuse me. The context of this statement is what? It is Samuel confronting Saul, the first king of Israel, at his disobedience in what God had instructed him to go and to utterly destroy the Amalekites. Okay, and this is you know, when Saul is coming back with his army after defeating them, and he's got all the spoils of war that were kept, right? And Samuel goes out to meet him, and he confronts him with it. Why didn't you obey God? And what was Saul's initial response? I did obey God. And Samuel says, well, if you obeyed him, then what's this lowing of cattle I hear and this bleating of sheep? You say? And exactly, Saul's response to that was, the people, they wanted to do this. And I kept Agag as the king, you see. And of course, then the response that Samuel gives that Ted just read for us, to obey is better than what? Sacrifice. Okay? And that concept will play a very important role in the ministry of Jesus. Okay? So keep that particular part in mind.
When I look at God, never forgave him, even though he asked for forgiveness, but he turned his back on Saul after that,
right?
Because of, I don't think he must not have been sincere in his unlike David,
right,
in asking God for forgiveness, but he just that called.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. You know, we can look at the difference between, you know, Saul's repentance and David's repentance. I mean, you know, David committed adultery and then murder to cover it up, and yet God forgave him. What's the big difference? And we'll see here again, this is an important factor that plays in the part in the ministry of Jesus, that everything has got to come from the heart. Amos and Isaiah, during this particular, you know, time period, told the people that Yahweh despised their worship and was sickened by their sacrifices. I've got somebody that's reading Amos 5, verse 21 through 24, I think it is. Would you read that for us, Pat? Okay. Isaiah 1, verses 11 through 15. Who's got that? Okay, you know, the message is very plain. God will not be worshipped and cannot be known apart from commitment to righteousness and justice, faithfulness and love. The prophets preach this over and over and over again. Now, what we find is these three lessons from this particular point in history are carried over and found in the teachings of Jesus. Okay? For instance, the sovereignty of God and Christ as king over all men. You see? Even those who don't believe in him is found throughout Jesus' teachings. You see? Jesus came Why? John 3:16. God so loved the world, thank you, not the Israelites, you see, but the world. Does that not express God's sovereignty and His rule over all men, you see? Not just over one group of people. Jesus makes it very plain and clear in His teachings. He did not come just to save a group of people. He was not going to be the Messiah of just the Israelites. He would be the Messiah of all men. See, so we find that particular lesson from the history of the Israelite people. We find that within the teachings of Jesus. The demand for moral character of God's people in adherence to His teachings, we find. John chapter 8, verse 32. To the Jews who had believed in Him, Jesus said, "If you hold to My teachings, you are truly My disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." So again, we see, you know, this neglect by the people of Israel in this earlier period to God's laws and God's demands and their refusal to obey Him. Jesus makes that a major point in His teachings. You see? He brings that to the forefront of who He is and why He is here. And then the third thing is the requirement of moral and practical observance from the heart over all religious observance. I think I asked somebody to read for us Matthew 15, 1 through 9. Who's got that? Tom, would you read that for us, please?
"Then the scribes and Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to Jesus saying, 'Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders, for they do not wash their hands?'" "Why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? For God commanded, saying, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and 'He who curses father or mother shall him be put to death.' But you say, 'Whoever says to his father or mother, whatever profit he might have received from me is a gift to God,' then you do not honor his father or mother. Thus you have made the commandment of God of no effect on your tradition. Nor did Isaiah the prophet stand as about me, saying, 'These people draw near to me with their mouth, and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.'"
So here we find a particular example in the teachings of Jesus where He specifically goes back to that period and points out to them their disobedience of God's laws and what Isaiah had to say about it, and how important and significant that was to them at that moment. You see? In other words, Jesus did not want the message of the prophets to be lost on, you know, the people of their day. And so He continually brought those messages, and in particular this message of the importance of worshiping God from the heart, not just going through the motions of religious practices. You see? So Jesus has taken up that cause, and hopefully you see from this, as we look at Jesus and get to know Him better through the Old Testament, why were these things so important? Why did Jesus spend so much time teaching about these kinds of things? You see? Was it a message, you know, just for us today? No. It was a message for them at that particular point, you see. And it was a message that the people even before them needed to have but ignored. See? Now, here's the real key to it. What happened to the people in the previous era that ignored that message? Yeah. They were punished, weren't they? And Jesus' message that he brings from that period of history into his ministry is, you've got to do these things this way, or you too will be punished. Okay? So you see the connection, you know, of all of these events. They're not just, you know, events that are just kind of random, you know, throughout the Old Testament. We read this story, read that story, read this one and that one, and maybe there's a little bit there, but oh no, these things, this is a pattern that is very neatly woven through. See? That Jesus took, and in essence you can say, you know, saw and knew the shortcomings of those who were God's people, and took that message and expounded on it, you see, and even made that message apply to you and I today. Okay? So we see that influence on the ministry of Jesus and all of these events that had been occurring up until that time. Now, next week, we will look at the period of from the end of the exile to the Messiah. Okay? Which will include, by the way, what is referred to as the intertestamental period. So, if you want to do a little bit of preparation, you know, ahead of time, then you might could go and read on some of that. All right? Thank you all very much.